Well, remote. Over the course of many years of recruiting and training and managing sales teams, I was always surprised when certain sure bet salespeople failed. Educated, smart, lots of experience, they were closers. And yet they were gone after weeks or a few months. They just never made it. And then there are people who were, they were long shots. But there's something about them that just kind of intrigued me or caught my eye. And I figured, well, you know, you just never know. I'll give them a chance. And then they turn out to be some of the top people on the sales team. I started, you know, reflecting on, well, what was it about these various people that failed? There's so many different reasons they would fail. A lot of times it would be excuses. Well, you know, I ran out of money. Or, well, you know, I don't really like this. Or a lot of times they just left and they wouldn't say anything. That was actually most of the time they would just leave. So it was really hard to find out, like, why they left. And if you're building teams professionally, you need to know that. In engineering, they have what they call failure modes. They want to know how complex devices or even simple devices, how do they fail? How does a concrete beam in a building or a steel beam in a bridge or a component of a car, an electronic component, how do they fail? What's the mean time between failures? MTBF. Standard engineering term. You can actually buy parts and specify, you know, in hours, like 1,000 hours, more like 1,000,000 hours or 5,000,000 hours. You want to pay a little extra, you can get a lot more reliable component. They have more rigid standards on manufacturing them. So, you know, when you're making parts for NASA, they don't want things to fail. That's why those satellites cost the shuttle. They cost a lot of money because they, you know, over-engineer them and they overbuild those things because they can't afford a catastrophic failure. Billions of dollars and set back a program by 5 years. So in sales, I was always curious, like, why do salespeople fail? So this topic may be construed as negative. You know, a lot of salespeople expect pep rallies and, you know, they want to have positive attitudes and something uplifting. And to them, I suggest they go to a really nice, loud church on Sunday morning and, you know, uplift themselves all they want, but we need to talk about reality here for a while. The secondary benefit of this is to immunize you. Why would they purposely inject viruses into your body so they can cause an immune reaction under a controlled circumstance? So when you come across the real virus, in large quantities, it's really virulent, you won't die. It's called vaccinations. So I want two objectives here. I want you to understand, as a professional, the mentality and psychology of your profession, how it works, why people succeed and why people fail. I also want to immunize you against, some of these, there's like 40 different failure modes I have listed, and some of these will apply to you because they apply to everybody, including me. Everybody has their own unique failure mode. One person may not have a problem with one, but another one, that's their death. So being forewarned is being forearmed. This is an exercise, too, of removing your ego and admitting to yourself, yes, I have this problem, or yes, I tend to do this, too. Then you know what you need to work on, right? If you know you'll overeat, you really shouldn't go to the Cheesecake Factory for lunch. Because they have all little cheesecakes in the case there, each one of which is 15 trillion calories. You know what I mean? You don't want to go there for lunch. You should go to the salad place, like everybody else at noon. And then at 2:30, while everybody else goes and gets a coffee, you sneak out and go to the Cheesecake Factory and get that piece of cheesecake because you're starving. You starved yourself at noon. And now you deserve that piece of cheesecake. By the way, that's a common, you know, ploy by people who claim they never eat anything. Well, I had a salad for lunch. What they neglect to mention is the piece of cheesecake at 3 o'clock. Just go to all the little coffee shops by the office buildings and watch everybody come in at 2:33 and they're all eating cake and stuff. Same people you can see a couple hours earlier eating salads, being all good in front of their friend, but they'll sneak the cake when no one's looking. That's their failure mode. Their failure mode is under-eating during lunch to the point where their body thinks it's starving. They didn't really get a proper meal. They should have just had a chicken sandwich or something reasonable. So they're trying to pretend they don't eat. And then they binge eat later. That's their failure mode as far as their diet is concerned. Okay? Anyway, there's a lot of different examples. And I'm not necessarily saying these are in order. They're just all relative. All valid. A real commitment. They're just visiting. They're going to kind of check it out and see how it goes. Okay? They'll kind of come in, they'll drop in, see how it goes. You leave. You ever go to the movie theater and you're all settled in, and then some idiot, of course, sits right in front of you, and it was 5 or 10 minutes into the movie, and then they get up and they leave. Or someone else sits to stand behind you and they're chit-chatting, right? And then it's, you know what they're doing is they're hanging out in your movie theater while until their movie starts instead of just waiting in the lobby like they're supposed to. They have no qualms about interrupting you in your movie, though. These people are interlopers. An interloper is someone in a place they don't belong. Okay, like you're crashing a wedding. Right? So what happens, you get a lot of people in sales because, in general, there are a lot of sales jobs. The bar is kind of low. They'll let pretty much anybody in. So that'll take people in, like real estate's like that. Any idiot who can pass the stupid little real estate exam can be a real estate agent. It's really not that hard. And look at the kind of people who are attracted to that profession. You want to call it that. There's a lot of people in there totally clueless. And yet, there's a lot of really professional realtors. Actually, realtor is a membership. You have to qualify for that as opposed to real estate agent who have, you know, studied, sometimes even have a bachelor's degree in real estate. And they know the market area. They're really professional. They do it full time. They're not screwing around. Those people will out-earn the interlopers and the pretenders by 20 to 1 easily. This is a whole other ballgame. But when you don't make a commitment, you're just kind of visiting to kind of see how it is, you're very likely to fail. Because there are no easy sales jobs. If there was, everybody would just do that job. What there is different types of hard work. You can go this kind of hard work, you can go that hard work, they're all hard. Sooner or later, you just have to, you know, pick one. You know, if you live to be 1,000, then you guess you can keep hopping around. But I see countless job hoppers going from place to place to place. They're 3 months here and 5 months here and 3 months here. Well, they're looking for, you know, easy money, but they're never making a commitment. That's the key thing. Even if they were looking for easy money, if they made a commitment and stayed in one place, they'd still have a good chance of success. So inside, they never really wanted the job. They just took it because they need a place to be. And as soon as a real job opens up, they're gone again, especially in the commission sales versus salaries. They really want a salary job because they're just not that ambitious. They take a commission job because they can't do anything else because the economy's bad. So right now, the world is rife with interlopers looking, you know, flitting from here to there. So number two. All talk. To show up a weak ego, and for someone that really has no self-esteem, they will resort to bragging. They'll talk a big game. And the louder they talk, typically, the less they deliver. It's just, you know, animals have this tendency in the wild. It's very dangerous to fight another animal because you can get killed and eaten, or you can get scratched and get a disease. Either way, it's bad for you to actually fight someone else. You don't have to fight. You're better off just leaving. What they do is they put on what they call a display, and they puff themselves up. Birds will have feathers that puff way up. There's umbrella cockatoos that have that really crazy little thing on their head that goes way up, makes them look like they're 5 inches taller. And they'll posture. Lions will roar, and they'll go into a fighting stance, and gorillas will beat on their chest. And poser salespeople will talk how great they are and how they close this and they close that. Talk, 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 talk. We all know these people. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They never deliver, though. And usually they leave. Just when it comes time that it's obvious they better start delivering, they come up with some other bullshit excuse why they have to leave. Well, I don't like this job. The boss is an asshole, quote-unquote. Well, They start getting called though. That, well, where's your deal? They painted themselves in no corner. So they quit, which means they're gone, which means it's a failure mode. Making no commitment. Back to number one briefly. Means that you will go from job to job. And if you know you're not gonna, and when the going gets tough, you're gone. And number three, the blame game. This is someone who, it's always someone else's fault. No matter what happens, it was someone else's fault. Well, who did that? Everything's always wrong. Everybody else is wrong. They have an excuse for everything. Person who can't deliver, cannot admit that it's his fault because the primary consideration is defense of the ego. The ego will take on, you know, a life of its own. It will do anything to protect itself. You can't possibly admit any kind of faults or failures or weaknesses. Introspection is the enemy. Therefore, it projects. It'll say, well, it could be, like, so say you're paranoid. It'll look around and say, some guys, you know, think something bad might happen. Well, you're paranoid. Or someone who always happens to be in the restroom when the check comes calls everybody else cheap. Well, you're really a cheapskate, you know that? This is projection. It's Psych 101. So what they do is they blame others. You know, you're argumentative. How can you be so damn argumentative? What's wrong with you anyway? Got it? So they walk around always blaming. It's always someone else's fault. Therefore, they can't improve. They can't learn anything because they cannot accept or admit that they have any deficiencies, that they need, there's things they don't know or can't do. So they basically, you know, are petrified. They stop. Their emotional and mental development stalls out. They actually become kind of childlike, like little second, third, and fourth graders. Actually, I only want to blame second, third, or fourth graders. Don't necessarily have to be that way. Somewhat childish, anyway, in that they have this regressive element to them. An adult would say, you know, I screwed up. I can see what I did wrong. I'm going to learn what to do better next time. I'm going to go forward. Right? Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I really messed that up. Instead of blaming someone else for it, they'll say, oh, yeah, I screwed up. I know people who cannot possibly say that. They can never say, I'm wrong, I screwed up, I made a mistake. They can't do it. Number four, life is unfair. Life is unfair. Everything's unfair. That's unfair. This is unfair. Well, the thing is, they may be right. Maybe that is unfair. Maybe it is unfair that women statistically earn less than men. That there's some people who are prejudiced against other people by age, race, sex, or whatever. And we have to live with their, you know, biases and prejudices. That the power structure, you know, these guys got their real estate in the 1800s and were paying $100,000 for a lot and they had a half a square mile for $20. Well, it's unfair that a lot of the merchants in Mill Valley, where I live, are being pushed out of Mill Valley because the guy keeps raising the rent. And literally one guy owns all the real estate almost in downtown Mill Valley. The family bought it all up in the 1800s, and then all of a sudden the town went upscale. And so there's basically, you know, pushing people out, and they're changing the mix of the town so it's not like it was anymore. It's going to the, you know, stores, only stores can go in or can afford to rent, so all the quirky little interesting ones are getting pushed out. That's not fair. Okay? Maybe it's not fair. So, the point being, there's 6.5 billion people on the planet. There's an injustice on every corner, and all kinds of things that are unfair. That's also a value judgment. Unfair considered compared to who? From whose point of view is that unfair? The real estate owner says, look, my family was here first. We made the investment. We built the buildings. We took all the risks. And if I can get the rent, it's a free market economy, then I'm going to get what I can get for my property. You'd do the same thing if you own the damn property. You're only saying that because you don't own it. So from his point of view, it's perfectly reasonable to, you know, maximize his personal gain by raising his rent. If you can get a better job making more money elsewhere, most people would quit and go take that job. They're not going to feel any undue loyalty to the previous employer. You say, well, if you can match what I was paying, I'll stay. If not, then buy. That's a free market economy. You get three people want to look at your car. One guy will give you $10,000, one will give you $9,500, one only wants to pay you $9,000. The one who pays, only wants to pay you $9,000 is going to say, you know, that's really unfair. I can't afford $10,000. $9,000 is all I can possibly raise. Why should that guy get the car and not me? This is a telltale sign of someone who's literally emotionally and mentally immature and or bought into the whole socialist phenomena philosophy that somehow we're all supposed to get something equal and everybody's supposed to get the same out of life, right? Well, there's one guy, why that person, you know, is that person, God love him more than he loves me or something like that? You could bring your deities into it if you like. By the way, I can read this list of 40 in about 3 minutes if I took my time, which is what I have on the website. This audio will probably be broken down into two sections. I'll probably do one this week and one next week because, you know, these are somewhat complex topics in a way if you really think about them. If you were the kind of a person who blamed everybody else all the time, and I said, well, you're all blame game. It's always someone else's fault. You have excuses for everything. Next, life is unfair. And I went right by it like that. What would you gain out of this? It's the kind of thing we almost need to reflect on. You need to meditate on it, absorb it. And then, and, you know, privacy of your own head, unless you're still hearing all those voices in there, in which case it might be pretty crowded. You might want to, you know, consider me? Blame other people? Never. Me be a braggart with no delivery? Not making commitments? Always whining about how life is unfair? No, I never do that. Okay. I'm happy that you're perfect. And at the end, after we get to number 40, we're going to build shrines to you all over the world as the perfect being. Like the, it'll be you and the Buddha, you know, to the enlightenment on earth under the banyan tree. Right? That perfect state. All right. Entitlement. You know, I'm owed a commission. I'm owed pay. It doesn't matter what I deliver, you know. But there's people who actually believe that they're entitled to things. The only problem with entitlement is that when you get things, inevitably you're getting them for other people who also have that same attitude of being entitled and not thinking they should have to give you their stuff for nothing. So when you say you're entitled and you deserve, like, free health care, what's wrong with getting free health care? That's a human right. That's a human right if you can convince all the drug companies and all the shareholders and employees of the drug companies, all the builders who build the clinics and hospitals, all the people who empty bedpans, all the people who manufacture electronic equipment, all the doctors who went to school for like 14 years, all the nurses, all the hospital administrators, everything, all those thousands and thousands and thousands of people, just convince them they should all go live in the dirt somewhere. We'll get a big empty lot and just dump them all out there and they can live there for free, in which case they'll work for free for you. So the last time I looked, healthcare was a very expensive, very, very expensive service to deliver. It's a little bit more complex than a haircut. And yet I don't know anybody who will cut your hair for free. So what does free healthcare mean? Free healthcare means you want someone else to pay for your healthcare. Of course, they want you. So you want Bob to pay for your healthcare. The problem is Bob wants you to pay for his healthcare. So while you're stealing $20 out of his left pocket, his hands and yours stealing $20. And when you're done, everybody paid for their own health care somehow, except for the people who don't work. So if you tax people for health care, only people who don't pay for health care are people who don't work. Of course, people who don't work are entitled to free health care because the sense of entitlement is almost a 100% fatal condition. Because the person expects and demands others to do something for him for free, and that therefore he absolves himself of all responsibility to do anything for himself. Now, if that person just had a routine job sitting in front of a console somewhere or whatever it was, you know, he might be able to slide by doing that. But in an entrepreneurial commission-only sales position where you're getting paid for performance, this obviously won't work. And yet, they're here. They have this sense of entitlement, and yet they're in this job. And I'll tell you why. A lot of times it's because their parents gave them that sense of entitlement. They grew up in a middle to upper middle class environment. They were sent to elite schools and, you know, daycare centers and preschools, private schools, private colleges. They were given things all the time. And then they get out and they realize that they're not going to work their way up the ladder and take a job and work their way up. It takes too long. So they want some kind of a get-rich-quick scheme. So in combination with the easy money, get-rich-quick idea, they also still feel entitled. They want the money now. They want what their parents earned the hard way. But they want it right now, and they don't want to work for it. So these failure modes actually happen in concert, just like the keys of a piano. It might be one, it might be 20 different ones all working together in some type of discordant harmony. The sense of entitlement, it's almost not curable. Eventually, if they get beat down a little bit, they may, you know, dissuade themselves from that idea, but most of the time they'll just get angry and they'll start blaming everybody. Then it'll add the blame game to the sense of entitlement. And it'll be like throw temper tantrums. Why did they get their way a lot of life? But they'll never, you know, hold it up that they should have to do something and take responsibility for their own results. That will never enter their mind. If a person did want to change and had that sense of entitlement, so the odds are one of you on this call has this, and you're not admitting it right now, of course. But if you want to change that, what you need to do is you need to volunteer to help disadvantaged people as a mentor or just whatever, volunteer work. And surround yourselves with people who have nothing and yet whose attitudes and outlook on life is probably extremely positive. Not necessarily, but a lot of them are. Now, there's also poor people who have never had nothing, also a sense of entitlement. They get that from the welfare thing. They think it's, you know, they're broke, therefore the government should give them money, and the government gave them money and reinforced that belief. Or there are moochers on a street corner who deserve a dollar. Give me a dollar. And people not wanting to have conflict, not wanting to take any chance that a person might become violent, will succumb to this petty extortion and give them a dollar, doing both you and the extortionist a great disservice. If you wanted to act responsibly, you'd look them right in the eye and go, why should I give you a dollar? It's my dollar. What are you going to do for it? Why should I give you this dollar? Are you going to do something for me? Why don't you give me a dollar? Give me a dollar. You know what I'm saying? That would, like, if nothing else, at least awaken them slightly towards reality briefly, and then they'd go back into their little deal again. In my opinion, one of the worst things you could do for your kids is send them to an elitist school like Yale or Harvard, where supposedly they're going to have a better shot at a success in life because they're what? They're going to have this degree with some prestige. That degree is only prestigious amongst other people in the Ivy League community who walk around sniffing each other's ass. Where's your degree? Do you go to MIT? You know, to them, that's really classy. I could care less. Of course, in my business, having a degree from Harvard would be a huge disadvantage. But you got this alumni network, so you can join this elite, you know, stratified, prestige-seeking, you know, group. Does not mean you're going to have a good life or a happy life doing that. Or even be successful. I see people with their Yale stickers on pretty crappy-looking cars. Not everybody, I guess, graduated top of their class and networked hard enough. And yet there they are, still proud of that degree. Usually what they did is they ruined themselves with that degree. They were ruined. They were led to believe that they were special and, you know, elitist. They had this sense of entitlement. Number six, dinosaurs that will not adapt or change. It used to be, and it still is in many more primitive cultures, that change is actually frowned upon, and it's almost the enemy. They will ostracize you if you try to change anything, because change means risk, and risk means that you're jeopardizing survival. If it worked this far and we're all still alive, leave it alone. They've had enough lean years and famines and droughts and tried some things that were disastrous. I can give you a lot of examples out of history, but I don't want to digress that far. But a lot of cultures right now, they do not, they worship their ancestors and tradition, or tradition-bound cultures. And I'm amazed a lot of times I go to Thai food restaurants and they have the exact same menu. And then around here, of course, there's some innovative places that are great. They're really, you know, taking the cuisine to the next level. And I go back to the Thai food restaurants. I went to one last night that are just real traditional, and it's almost inedible. I can't even eat this stuff anymore. It's just bad. It might have been nice for 600 years, but you know what? They've learned some things on how to cook. And just because you've been doing it that way for that long doesn't mean it's any good. There's a lot, you know, these other guys, Thai, he's doing a lot better, you know, more interesting dishes. But people won't adapt or change because they are bought into the way things were. A lot of times they were successful before doing it this way, like they were in glad-handing insurance salesmen. Well, I can get you the $50,000 policy, or I can give you the $100,000. Which one do you prefer? They go with the same bullshit standard closes, same obvious pitch. They want to do the same thing. You know, all these real estate agents and all these mortgage brokers who had the free ride during the debt-fueled crapshoot subsidized loans and stuff. Everybody, you know, made all these loans that everybody knew were bogus. And they basically scammed the system until the government's going to step and have to clean it all up again. God knows how many billions of dollars to clean up this one. So they were riding this gravy train, participating in the thievery, as far as I'm concerned, of making these mortgage loans and, you know, no interest down seconds and thirds and all whatever else they're doing. And now the whole thing's crumbling. So they'd love to go back to the happy days. Well, look, I can go back and be a mortgage broker. Anybody can be a mortgage broker. You're walking off the street, they'll make you a mortgage broker or a real estate agent. And now they're all rats, like rats leaving a sinking ship. They're gone. Now I'm getting bombarded with their resumes, and pretty much all of them are useless because what they bought into was some scam, easy money. You just have to dial a phone, you get any money. They don't know what a real sales job feels like. But they don't want to change, though. They're going to want to believe that that'll come back. They're going to have to find it real hard. There's a lot of people in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, and so on. You know, they want things the way they were before. Well, they're not. In nature, species that don't adapt with a changing environment are referred to as extinct. That's what happens to them. They go extinct. So when you change a job, when you change a job, not necessarily, but often, you have to change and adapt to that new environment that you're going to be in. So a lot of people will go into a sales job and they'll try to continue to do what worked for their last sales job. And it will, sometimes it might work. They might do it again, it might work. And the third time, they're dead. It just flat, they can't believe, they're incredulous that they failed. And they don't think, you know, flexibly. So again, that's a failure mode, in that if you do that, you're increasing the odds of your failure. Number 7, sell and pitch. Well, this relates to the previous one. The stereotype of the glad-handing, fast-talking, glib, con artist sales guy. Just selling and pitching all the time. Was never really effective. I think some people will manage to, you know, intimidate and bulldoze through people. They're a little weak-willed. But for every one of those, they turned off many people because they just didn't trust them. So it's, who knows how much sales they could have made if they weren't, you know, lying to people all day long. So that whole stereotype, you know, I'm a salesman, therefore I have to do this. Always be closing. Glenn Gary, Glenn Ross. ABC. Always be closing. People are too smart nowadays. There's too many different movies and television programs, the internet. I mean, you can find out everything about everything. With all these different cable TV channels. There's shows just on poker. You know what I mean? On how to take care of dogs and train them. They have shows on, five different shows on how to make, you know, customized Harley Davidsons. I mean, they got shows on everything, how to fix up houses, fashion, cooking, everything. I mean, knowledge is just out there. People are just a little bit more aware right now. So if you try to use the techniques from the 60s and the 50s today, you know, you're going to look like an idiot. And yet some people, like I said, they have this stereotype in mind. So that's what they think sales is. They come across as unprofessional, insincere, and stupid. And it's like they're insulting your intelligence when they talk to you. It's really prevalent in the auto thing when the auto salespeople tend to be old school. And most of them are two-bit little hustlers who don't know their product. And they're just insincere, and I don't really want to do this with them. I don't know anybody else who does. I'm going to pause for comments.
Well, I went through all phases, Paul, of what you just described. This is Roy. The old school, which was make 300 calls a day, close in the first second, 7 seconds, otherwise it's over, etc. And this technique and system of selling that you've presented took a lot of unlearning to understand and internalize. And I'm a slow learner, but once I do wrap my brain around it, I'm hoping for some good results.
Well, thank you, Ray. Anybody else?
Well, I think that, you know, your comments on adapting and changing with the times and not going extinct struck a chord with me.
Why is that?
Because I continually find myself making the same stupid mistakes that I've been trained lately not to do. And it's almost like they're ingrained in me. I can't kill the bug, you know? So I constantly have to be conscious and aware of not doing that sales pitch all the time. It's not as easy as it sounds to quit that.
Well, every one of these almost can be considered almost like an addiction. It's an addiction is a mental pattern that is compulsively followed. Whether it's driven from some kind of a physical craving or just psychological. But in a way, like I said, it's like an addiction, and it's really hard to see yourself and to know yourself, what you really are, more objectively, because you can't be objective about yourself. You're inside. So in effect, you're trying to do an unnatural act, which is to see yourself objectively. That sounds easy, but it's not. And then to actually change is a very difficult thing because it's just so much. You get into a pattern, and it's easy. One of the things you can do to break habits is to purposely disrupt the pattern. So if you find yourself pitching, you know what I'm saying? And you know you're pitching.
Yeah.
And what you have to do is you have to say, all right, when I see myself pitching, I'm going to stop and ask a question. Now, I was going to a counselor and I was having this problem with, you know, I get a little over-exuberant when I'm driving and I start getting pissed off. And that's a dangerous thing, you know what I mean? So I made a deal. I took his car and I wrote out, if I swear at a car in front of me, I have to pull over for 5 minutes. And when you want to get somewhere and you're in a hurry, that's exactly the opposite of what you really want to be doing, right? Because it literally over the side of the road for 5 minutes, it feels like a century, right? But what does 10 years in San Quentin for vehicular homicide sound like? I think I'd take the 5 minutes on the side of the road, you know what I'm saying? I used to be a lot worse, by the way, but the point being is that you can let yourself escalate into a pattern of allowing someone to, you know, tailgate you, becomes irritated. And it was real hard for me to let someone tailgate me and not get all pissed off, but I actually, like, made a game out of it. I saw Cal, tell you what, the guy's not trying to kill me personally. Probably, unless he's one of my old salespeople. That's usually where the laughs go, but never mind. He's probably just in a hurry, and he's going to target, you know, the next person after me, then the next person after that. So I'm just going to sit there and wait it out. The odds are, I hope, as long as I don't, if there's a lane, he'll pass me. You know what I mean? I don't have to escalate into an argument and give him the finger, right? Because then he might shoot you. And then, you know, you've accomplished nothing, right? So my pattern was that, you know, I would always drive fastest enough lane. I made myself move over a lane and go down a little bit slower. And instead of, like, giving the guy the finger and, you know, whatever I was, you know, trying to do to make it a little bit more entertaining to drive, I would just let him tailgate me. And just, you know, and after a while, it just didn't bother me anymore. At first, I thought I would never be able to do that. There's no way I can let someone tailgate me. There's no way I can drive slower. And I found out that, you know what, it's actually more relaxed and a lot easier to do that. It was actually easy. Now it would be hard for me to go back in there and try to drive at the 100% limit of the left lane. It's just too stressful. It's not worth it. You know what I mean? So I was breaking a habit. So a lot of these are habits. A lot of these, you know, require introspection. And above all, you have to remove your ego from the equation. You have to understand about the ego and how it tries to defend itself. Well, again, if you can live to be 1,000 years old, you wouldn't have to worry about this. But you only got 75 to 80 years to get it right, to maximize what you're going to get out of this life. You got no time for that. You just have to say, you know what, I was brought up in private schools, and I went to college, and I was, you know, by elitist college professors, and I've been inculcated in this idea that somehow I'm special. You know what? I'm not special. I was just, you know, privileged, but in a lot of ways disadvantaged by going to this kind of a school. I should have just went to a good state school. Could have got the same education without all the elitist trappings, which gave me a lot of bad habits, unless you're trying to be a politician. But then again, how many actually succeed? I mean, you can go to the State Department and get your degree from Georgetown, you know. That might carry some weight, but the rest of the world doesn't care. They want to know what you can do, you know what I mean? So there are ways to break these habits. If you see that you can't change your past habits, that you're falling back in a rut, and you need to purposely take yourself out of your present environment and force yourself to do different things. Like me, I've never been to the opera. I never want to go to the opera. I hate the opera. So here's what I would do. If I wanted to practice changing my perspective, I would go to the opera. Who knows? I might enjoy it. Right?
I doubt it.
Me too, but you never know. But the idea is if I go to the opera, it would definitely be something I haven't done. It would have to shake me, you know what I mean? It would show me that I could do different things or adapt, right? If you're not the kind of person who dances, you have to get up and dance. If you go to a karaoke bar, you have to sing. You have to do something to kind of put yourself out a little bit to kind of break your habits. If you take the easy way out, you need to do a strenuous physical challenge. There are always, you know, cures. And as we move along here, I think what I'll do is I'll intersperse some of the cures. No real commitment. You're just visiting. You're on vacation from a present job.
Well, my perspective, Paul, personally, is this. I could run from this and go somewhere else and look for an easier path, but what will I have achieved? And believe me, I'm up against the wall right now. I am determined to beat this devil. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
And so you may think I'm nuts for still hanging around here and not making any deals. Maybe I am nuts. I don't know. But I ain't a quitter. So... I don't know what to say. I'm just determined as hell to overcome these little, because I know there are little quirks.
Number eight is lazy and spoiled. Look, if you're lazy in most circumstances, most real jobs, that's, you know, it's just not going to work. You're done. Your history. You need a salary job, preferably with the government. It's where you can get by doing the bare minimum. Some place to hide out. You need to, like, mooch off other people. Let your wife work, your husband, or whatever it is. But, you know, if you're lazy, accomplishment will more likely be beyond you. Now, to counterbalance that, laziness can also be efficiency, and that is the hallmark of all great engineering. What you're looking for is a better way to do things. When you're designing a sales process or engineering any mechanical or whatever physical device, you're looking for efficiencies because you're lazy. Like, I don't want to get up and keep turning the volume of the TV on and off, so I'll invent a remote control. There you go, a breakthrough. So that's not actually bad as long as you understand what you're doing. Now, if you're lazy, you may become more effective and efficient. You don't want to work 8 hours, so you'll just get a lot more done in 4 hours. That could be a good thing. So if inherently some people just don't really have the energy level as other people, they might be considered lazy only because they literally don't have the same thermostat, the same energy level. I see this all the time around me. I happen to have a very high energy level. Other people don't. They can't work, 14 hours. Well, fine. You know, what you have to do is you have to match your energy level to your goals. You have to work smart, work not necessarily longer hours or harder, but just more efficiently or delegate more. There's a lot of workarounds where you can still accomplish things. But if you're just too lazy in general where you won't even think about those things, then you're basically not going to accomplish much unless you're in some protected environment. Laziness is also indicative of someone that doesn't have a goal in life. Why don't they have goals? Because they were raised in a more of a nihilistic philosophy that there is nothing matters, you're just going to die when you die, you're just worm food. Nothing matters, doesn't matter what you do, it's hopeless. They just don't, they're pretty much apathetic. Therefore, why should they bust their ass? There's nothing worth owning. Money is a joke. It doesn't really matter how much money you have. Rich people can be all depressed and kill themselves. You know what I mean? They were passed from grade to grade. They didn't really have to ever work hard before. So there's all these different aspects of this. You have to really delve into this. If you're not accomplishing what you want to accomplish out of life, it's your life. Look at your life. And ask yourself what you want out of it. Maybe laziness is simply, you weren't inspired. Again, avoiding the word motivation, which I really don't like that much. You just weren't inspired to do anything because you didn't see anything that you really wanted to do. But if you found something you really loved to do, that so-called lazy person might end up playing the piano 12, 14 hours a day and become a famous concert pianist because he finally found the thing, or she finally found what she truly loved. And until then, there wasn't any point to anything. So laziness could be inherent in the person, or it could be a condition that they're experiencing because of lack of direction. Either way, though, as far as a sales position goes, it will kill you. You cannot, especially in an entrepreneurial sales position, for the most part, if you're lazy, it won't work, unless you're just that good where you can just crank out deals anyway. But if you're that good, you probably could have got 4 more deals if you worked harder and were good at it being a closer.